the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first it was kind of soy sauce, it was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history.
Welcome back to one more episode of Sake On Air, the sake and shochu and Awamori podcast, brought to you with the wonderful support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association and broadcast bi-weekly from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center here in Tokyo. My name is Justin Potts, and I am joined here together by two of our regular team members, our partners in crime here. With me here today, I have Sebastian.
Hello, Justin.
Sebastian, welcome back. I feel like we've done this before.
Yeah, indeed.
Strangely enough, we have. This is actually the second time we're recording this show, isn't it, Chris?
That's right. Yeah, I get a feeling of deja vu. We've been here before.
And sometimes the technical world doesn't always cooperate with us in the way that we hope it will. And every now and then, things don't come out as ideally as we would hope. And we want to try and make this sound as pretty as we can for all of you. So we're getting together once again to talk about Koji.
And the good news is there's a lot to say.
There's a lot to say.
There is a lot to say. And we've had a lot of time to reflect on the last recording and kind of maybe improve some contents as well.
For those of our listeners who are not entirely familiar with Koji and what it is we're talking about, it is essentially the element that is going to differentiate sake from banshochu, from other beverages, from other alcoholic beverages and spirits throughout the world, as well as all of the core elements and flavors of Japanese cuisine, because its use is not only limited to sake, shochu, awamori, it is also necessary for soy sauce, for miso, for rice vinegar, for mirin, for all of these different things. And while there's a lot more information out there about it nowadays, there are a lot more people examining this, a lot of people thinking about this, and not just people involved in brewing or specifically people looking at food and culinary and different other sorts of utility for koji.
And I think it gets taken a little bit for granted here in Japan as well, actually. I think if you ask the average, you know, Japanese person on the street what they thought about koji, they were probably, you know, maybe not. They've probably never given it much thought,
yeah,
to be honest with you.
It's something that is absolutely the cornerstone of the cuisine and the food culture here, but it's something that in this generation, a lot of people have not had any interaction with. They have probably not seen it. They probably don't know the process. They don't know where it comes from. They're familiar with the terminology, but really don't have any personal point of reference for what that means. So in any sake 101, any shochu 101, you're going to have to talk about what is koji? You're going to have to explain that. It may not come up in your taste in a sake tasting, but if you're talking about what is this sake stuff and where does it come from, is something we have to talk about. We'll jump over the main sake making process. For those who are interested in that, we do have a Sake 101 Basics episode. It is episode number 9. If you would like, feel free to press pause, jump back to episode number 9, give that a listen, and come back and visit us in about an hour. The basics of that are in there, so we're not going to get into a lot of the hyper detail of the sake production process here, but we do have to talk about what is sake and why is it important and why is it significant. Both of you gentlemen are spreading the sake good word to folks from all over the world. When koji comes up, at what point do you bring this up, and in what manner do you share this with people?
If I kind of have 4 points that I touch upon when I teach people about sake, I start off by telling people, first of all, that sake is not a spirit. And then secondly, I want them to know that it's not a wine. But at the same time, here comes point three, it's not beer. It's like beer. It's probably closer to beer in the way that it's made, but it's not beer. And then to elaborate, I say, and the reason for that is because we require this other ingredient called koji. And like I'm saying, I fill in the details as I go along, right? What about you, Sebastian?
Yeah, I think it comes up pretty early because most of my audience are people who are familiar with wine, as you were drawing us toward the direction. And that's the key difference with the wine brewing, with the wine making process, is the introduction of koji in sake brewing. So it comes up pretty rapidly anyway. And what I'm trying to do is actually I'm trying to show koji. Because koji exists as a product. You can find it. Not only in sake breweries, as it becomes fashionable in food and gastronomy, you can actually buy or find some koji in shops today.
Mm. So one of the points I throw in straight away, as soon as I possibly can, is that koji is often banded about as a word, but actually it can mean one of two things, right? Essentially, we could be talking about the name of the mold which you use to create the koji. So it's the name of the finished thing, which is basically like, so whatever you use, steamed rice, barley, you don't have to use rice. You could use anything that contains starch, basically. It's the thing which contains starch that you've inoculated the mold on. And just to make things really confusing, they decided that the mold and the finished thing with the mold growing on it would have the same name, koji. And in Japanese, they sometimes like, they put the word kin after, right? Kin is kind of like Japanese for bacteria, or I guess in this case, mold. And I have to admit, in the early days, I did use the word bacteria sometimes.
Yeah. And I know now it's still common out there.
Yeah, and I know it's not bacteria.
Yeah, it's super challenging because you're trying to tell somebody about a mold, and we'll talk about what that is in a minute, but it's essentially something that most people don't need to think about in their daily life. Mm. So it's really challenging because if you're wanting to learn more about sake, it's significant, but for the average person, it's more or less meaningless. But it is exciting. It is exciting. It is interesting. So kind of jumping back then to recap what you need in order to make sake, you need three things. And koji is one of those essential ingredients. It's necessary for the fermentation because you don't have those natural accessible sugars in the rice, the same that you would in, say, like a grape or something of that nature. So what you need is you need some way to get at those sugars that can then make those accessible for the sacrification that can then be turned into alcohol. Koji is what you use in order to do that.
Because the thing in beer making is that you germinate the barley, right? Yeah. So you have the germ in the barley and you basically release the enzymes from the germ by growing the barley into a plant. Because as it grows, it naturally releases those enzymes. Now, the thing about rice, with a few exceptions, there's normally no germ. So we don't have any enzymes. We have to provide the enzymes another way. And that is the job of this koji.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Koji and brings the enzymes that will break down the starch into fermentable sugars.
Exactly. Exactly. And I guess the one thing that's important to distinguish here, to point out, is that when we talk about making sake, the thing that distinguishes it as sake is the use of koji.
That's right. Yeah.
Before the use of koji, there's record of alcoholic beverages being made from other grains, including rice, through germination processes and things like that historically. However, when we talk about legal definitions of sake or nihonshu, as it's referred to here in Japan, we're talking about an alcoholic beverage made from koji.
That's right.
Which is from rice, in this case, in the case of sake.
Yeah.
And so that becomes an important distinction because right when you're talking about beer, it's possible to germinate grain of rice and use that in order to create enzymes to do that.
And it's much more likely that the origin of sake, the discovery of sake, is going to be germination. I mean, we don't have any records that prove this 100%, but it's more likely to be germination than it is koji. And of course, well, we do know that because koji didn't come, the process of making koji came from China, right? And it didn't come until the Nara era, where I don't know what that is.
I'd have to go back and look for its specific dates. But the earliest kind of reference that makes you go, oh, you can actually point to this as absolutely using koji. You're looking at, gosh, it's going to be about like 500 AD, somewhere in that range. I would have to go back and do it for a specific number. You're looking at,
1300
years of history.
Yeah. In other words, BC, before BC, well, BC, basically, they would have been actually making sake another way. So germination would be the obvious one. I mean, we anyone who's seen the film Kimi no Na wa, Your Name Is, there's a scene in there of some people kind of like chewing rice, spitting it out and creating sake that way. That's something that actually happened. It's called mouth chew sake. And basically, we have one of the amylase enzyme in our saliva. So you can actually break the starch down by chewing the rice grains. And that's, we believe, how they were first making the sake, being made for religious ritual. No one was actually drinking this stuff because it sounds really horrible. And it was beautiful deities doing the chewing anyway, as you see. Well,
I actually do know a brewer who has actually made that sake with both male and female test subjects and then done blind really? Tasting on which ones taste better.
Is that, you can
the,
do
the,
that?
The female, the ones made by females in a blind tasting outstandedly received better
warning to our listeners. I mean, chew rice, making sake by chewing rice at your own
at your own risk. Brew at your own risk.
Yeah, but like if you've ever wondered why rice tastes sweet, a little bit sweeter when you actually chew it, well, that's one reason. You're partly breaking down some of that starch. Very trace amount has to be said. So yeah, I mean, germination was the original kind of method, and then koji making came later on. But it's very much the cornerstone of a massive part of modern brewing. As you said, legally, it's an absolute requirement.
And it's a requirement now, yeah. Exactly. So if you're going to make something called sake and you're going to sell something called sake in Japan, in that category, in that tax category, and all those other things, you have to use koji.
Yeah.
And where it becomes tricky is that the word koji tends to get thrown around in a number of contexts by brewers particularly, but even just in education or in informal settings when people are talking about sake and the qualities of sake, is the word koji just gets thrown around just as koji. However, it can refer to a couple of different things depending on the context. And that's where it starts to get a little bit tricky.
So it can refer to the mold itself. Let's call it a mold for now.
Yep, for now we'll call it a mold.
So it refers to the mold itself, or it refers to the finished, basically whatever you're using, the ingredient containing starch with the mold inoculated into it.
Yeah, so you're looking at, it's either the mold's spores, it's essentially spores, which they call it koji kin.
That's right.
That's referring to the mold. And that is what they use, which they sprinkle upon this steamed rice.
Yeah.
That then works its way into the rice, inoculates itself in there, and you see this sort of lovely white fuzzy action
where it's grown
that occurs.
It puts these this mold has these little legs called legs of feelers, called hypha, and it kind of burrows, it penetrates the rice grain with these feelers, and then they actually excrete enzymes into the rice grains. And then that's basically what's happening when you're making koji, and that's what the finished product is all about.
And then, it's a very careful process. It takes a number of days, under about 48 hours, give or take, under very specific conditions. And that's going to differ depending on what you're making with. But you have to make that. And then when you're done, that rice that you have that you're then going to use in sake brewing that has had the koji mold inoculated into it is, again, often just referred to as koji in a lot of contexts.
Right.
And so depending on the context within that which that person is speaking, they could be referring to the spores which are used to inoculate the rice, or they could be referring to the rice which has undergone this process and this is going to be used, and it is in a ready-to-use form.
That's right.
That can then be used in the brewing and fermentation
process. In English, we've kind of taken recently to kind of calling it... The thing that you absolutely shouldn't call it if you are going to try and translate into English is malted rice. That would be incorrect because it's not germination that's going on here.
Exactly. Functionally, why you're doing it, it's serving the same purpose.
Exactly.
But what you're creating is something distinct. And so you still see out there, you see rice malt. That's not exactly...
It's really not.
It communicates what it is you're trying to do, but it doesn't communicate the unique nature of... what it is in the components.
And probably the big, and it's not a wort either, really, because it's not like a wort is kind of like a sugary liquid that you've, it's not really a wort either. Probably the best English translation would be moldy rice, perhaps. And I've seen that being used. And it doesn't sound so attractive. I think if you can use koji. Yeah. But it really is a problem because it really isn't clear when you're using koji and koji and not referring to which one.
And that's something that is our job, which it's questionable how well we've done in actually making that really clear here. But it's, and you know, the job of those in a position to educate, we essentially have to permeate the world with this awareness of koji, and just having that is even it, whether they understand it or not. It's kind of like talking about yeast or something that are used in wine. Does everybody understand yeast? No, maybe not, but they can understand the function and its purpose. You say, oh, the yeast works on this and does this, and you get alcohol, you get wine.
And you were talking about yeast, and I hear very often Japanese people as well often come to me, you know, we're really, really sure, you know, that yeast is performing the same role as koji. So some people think that, yeah, no, the koji can actually produce alcohol, and it can't. It can only break the starch down. It only produces the enzymes. It doesn't even break down the starch down to sugar, actually. It just produces the enzymes that do that. You still need the yeast to produce the alcohol, and they are very different things.
Yep. What I hear more often is people referring to the koji production process as a fermentation. And this is, I think, not a correct way to describe it.
No.
What you often see is something called like a solid state fermentation, where you're actually creating something fermentable that is in a solid state, essentially. And it would technically, I guess, it would fall under that sort of category.
Yeah.
But it is not actual fermentation that is taking place.
It's not alcohol fermentation, at the very least. It's only performing one part of the brewing process. So you still need to apply the yeast and actually create alcohol from the glucose that the koji produces, right? Or the enzymes from the koji produce. But hey, so one question. So you keep referring to it as mold. Yeah. And I, in the early days, I used to refer to it as bacteria. I hold my hand up. You know, I'm guilty of that.
Yeah.
And I know now it's not a bacteria. I know that is very wrong. For a start, most people, I think, associate bacteria with being harmful. And koji mold is not harmful, right? You can consume it. It won't, you know, it won't harm you. So which is it?
So one, it is not a bacteria. What it would fall into the category of is a fungus.
Yeah.
If you want to get more specific, it would be a mold. The basic difference, so a bacteria is going to be prokaryotic, which means it has no membrane-bound organelles or a central nucleus, single-celled. Bacteria, you often see it working on things like cheeses, yogurts, curds, and things of that nature. A fungus is not a bacteria. It's going to be eukaryotic. It has a cell wall. It has a nucleus, organelles. It could be single or multi-celled. In the fungus category, you're going to have things like yeasts and molds.
That's right.
It's a kingdom
or a group.
And then if you want to get more specific, it's sort of a subset, I guess you could say, of fungus, is you're going to have a mold. The difference being, mold is going to be smaller in its more singular state. You're not going to be able to see it under the naked eye. We're talking about the hypha, which are generated. If you look at it up close, it kind of looks like a small branching tree or something like that. You're not going to be able to see it. But when those grow together on an organic surface, which in this case can be something like steamed rice, then it comes together and you're able to see this fuzzy colored substance.
Yeah.
In this case, if you're doing it right in making sake, your rice is going to appear white.
Yeah, white.
How does it look like for you?
How does it look?
Yes.
In what sense?
I mean, just to explain to our listeners, how did it look like?
I guess it looks like, so it depends on the, a lot of people have this image, and especially if you see really up close those, it looks furry, it looks hairy kind of. It's like a tiny grain of rice with a layer of fur kind of growing on it, almost like a cotton ball or something of that nature.
Yeah.
That being said, most of the koji that is actually used in sake production actually doesn't look all that furry.
No.
Might be a little bit, but not so much.
So they call this the haze. And basically it's the easiest way to describe haze is it's the pattern of mold growth on the rice. So sometimes you might want to grow the mold more on the outside of the rice and completely cover. And then other times you might want to have just a kind of a scattering of spots, a very kind of spotted growth on the outside. And then you want these hypha to kind of go deep into the shimpaku, the white heart in the middle of the rice. So you have sohaze, which is the former. So that's growing all on the outside, a very big mold growth. And then you have tsukihaze, which is kind of just a very, very, very spotted mold growth. And the hypha go right into the deep into the rice.
What's really amazing is how sake brewers manage to do that. I mean, to tweak the environment of the koji room to produce a particular type of koji. I mean, that's a true expertise.
It really, really is.
Just by controlling temperature.
That's right.
Humidity. And how you, I mean, basically move the rice or mix the rice.
That's right. The oxygen, how much oxygen gets into the rice.
Yeah. I mean, you're thinking about what sort of enzyme activity you want in the next stage. And so depending on what it is you're trying to make, you're going to, again, exactly as Sebastian just said, how you treat that in the process of that inoculation is going to be a little bit different. And so a lot of people think of koji as that sort of being the end game. Mm. Oh, I've got koji. What are you going to do with it? And so that's where the real craft and really a small miracle comes in when you think about it, when it comes to sake production, as well as other things like miso and soy sauce and things like that as well too.
It's often defined as the most intensive, work-intensive process in sake brewing. I mean, you've brewed sake. Justin, would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what you refer to as intensive. There are other parts that are, you know, physically demanding. But as far as just sort of the nature of the environment and the amount of time that you spend in there, and a lot of producers will tell you that you're not going to end up with a better sake than the koji that you're able to create, which means that you're very conscious of the state of the koji that you're making throughout the process. And you're doing it every single day, essentially, or at least in most cases, or in many cases. And so you're doing the exact same process over and over and over again. And what is essentially the same environment day in and day out, because you're doing that, you start to become sensitive to the minute differences at different stages at different places along the way. And so because of that, it demands a great deal of attention.
You have to get normally, I mean, not all breweries, a lot of breweries kind of revolutionizing and changing the work schedule, but traditionally there would be someone who would have to be on the night shift and get up in the middle of the night and kind of look after it. So, you know, you often hear some brewers referring to the koji making process as kind of looking after a newborn child or whatever. Yep. And we're not by any means, you know, trying to belittle childbirth or anything, you know, looking after a child. But, you know, I think that's quite cute and quite poignant as well.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of breweries who do that. There's still, in many cases, there are a lot of people who are responsible for staying overnight, or they live right next to the brewery, or they stay at the brewery, or they, you know, in shifts each night or every several nights, and they will go and they will stay up and they will wake up, whether it's every 2 hours or 3 hours, or depending on maybe the state that the koji was in when they went to bed, that will dictate then how much time they feel they have to dedicate to that throughout the night, you know. And that's still very, very common in sake production, and so...
Definitely a lot of concentration taking place.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And experience.
You don't joke in a koji.
No, not really.
And experience, really. Right? Because you need to know when things are not going right. And the only way you can do that, because there's no kind of rule book on this, right? It's the rice is different every year. A lot of the factors are different as well. So you need experience to know kind of how to adjust this koji making process to make sure that things go in the right direction. Ultimately,
yeah, and a lot of the small to mid-sized producers are still, you know, they're doing it in what they would call the kojimuro, which is often rooms that are constructed of cedar on a big cedar table, and it's relatively humid, it's relatively hot, and
the taste of koji. I mean, I think Chris, you said it earlier when you chew some rice and you leave rice in your mouth for a long time, it feels or it tastes sweeter. Yeah. I mean, clearly in koji, the enzymes have started to do their work. I mean, I'm talking about koji as the finished product here. And so definitely koji tastes sweet.
Yeah.
And we were referring to koji products you can find in the market. One of the uses of koji as a finished product is to make amazake, which is a sweet drink based on rice koji and water. So that's how it tastes.
Mm. But so talking about the koji, and we're talking about like as part of like the recipe, the overall recipe for sake, and they have like the 1-2-3s of sake brewing. Traditionally, they say that koji is number one, basically in terms of importance. And then number two would be the fermentation starter, yeast starter, shubo. And then you have the fermentation itself. So traditionally, they're basically saying, if you mess up the koji, that's it type thing. But in terms of the kind of koji that you would make in terms of the overall recipe, again, it does depend brewery by brewery. And it also depends on the type of the style of sake that you want to produce at the end. Because I briefly touched upon it earlier, but the starch isn't the only thing that the Golgi enzymes break down. You have this other enzyme, proteolase, which breaks down protein. And from protein, you get amino acids, glutamic acid, and ultimately umami. So if you have a Golgi which has got more mold on it, more breakdown of the protein, that's probably going to give you a more rich sake. But having more mold on there is the first kind of precursor. And then it comes down to the actual temperature in the fermentation and other things as well, how you kind of, you know, the actual fermentation style. So that's one thing, you know, because you would not really ever try and make a Ginjo sake with a Sohase Golgi, for example. It is done, but there's another kind of thing in there, which is relates to the water. But Sohase is generally not used to make Ginjo. You would use Tsukihase Golgi, so you have less of a mold growth on there and less kind of breakdown of the protein and less umami.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of examples of both, so it's hard There are.
Like on the traditional, in textbook, as far as textbook is concerned, you'd find it very difficult to make a Ginjo with Sohase Golgi. Getting the balance right in the fermentation tank would be a really difficult task. Not to say that brewers couldn't do it.
I think talking about proteins connects with what you were saying earlier, Justin, about the fact that sake's got cousins which are all using Golgi. You mentioned soy sauce, miso, mirin, rice vinegar, and so on. Because indeed, Golgi is the main ingredient of these, or one of the main ingredients of these cousins as well. And it comes down to producing the enzyme profile that is required to transform the starch into the aromas, the amino acids, the aromas that the product is supposed to deliver.
That's right. And shochu is also made with Golgi. But so we use a slightly different variation of the mold.
Yeah. So when we're talking about Nihonshu and we're talking about sake, we're referring to this Golgi mold that is known as Aspergillus oryzae.
Aspergillus oryzae.
Yeah, that's right. So we're talking about the Golgi. We're talking about this mold. There's many, many, many different types.
That's right.
There's many, many, many different varieties. A lot of them are used. A lot of them are not. When we're talking about the ones for sake, we're talking about this one called Aspergillus oryzae. And it is, a lot of times they're broken down into basic categories by color. And Japanese is called a Kikoji or a yellow Golgi. And this is often used to make sake. It's used to make amazake, like you were talking about, Sebastian, often for miso, and in soy sauce in cases as well, too. You see it across some of those different ones, but and all of those different things. And it is generally very common. It was used traditionally in making shochu and aomori as well, too. It was particularly aomori a long time ago, too. That was sort of the original version, I guess you could say, that was most common. You have other different types of yellow Golgi that are used that are also yellow, but have slightly different properties that are used to more often in making soy sauce or more often in making miso. Outside of that, the other colors that you primarily see in Japan would be black and white. Black is going to be what became commonly used in aomori and then shochu. And white Golgi is a spontaneous mutation of the black variety. It became more popular and shochu production, basically because it was a little less messy. When you're using these black spores, it tends to make everything kind of black, and it's also pretty intense. It produces quite a bit of acid, so it's pretty tangy. Shifting over to the white, it's a little bit more mild, a little bit more subdued for our quote unquote modern palates. A lot of people wanted something a little bit milder, so you saw a lot of people for production to clean up, to make production a little bit cleaner, as well as to appeal to a more recent palate preferences. You saw a greater shift to white, which become the kawachi, is what it's called. You saw that used quite often. Now what you're starting to see is actually a bit of that white being used in sake production as well, too.
That's right.
As producers are trying to create a little bit more tanginess, get a little bit more a different style of acidity integrated into the profile. And a lot of places are looking at white Golgi is a potential solution to that. So you're seeing a lot of different interpretations of
and
that.
It has actually a function as well. So one reason that a lot of breweries have started using white or black Golgi in their production is that, and of course, try not to go down a rabbit hole, but we will do a podcast, I'm sure, on the fermentation starter. But in the fermentation starter, one thing that you need to keep the wild bacteria out of the tank, one thing that yeast is strong against, but the wild bacteria are not, is acidity. And so traditionally, one way we create that acidity is to add acid into the fermentation starter. But if you use a koji, which is already high in particular citric acid, that will do the same thing. So a lot of breweries have started to use white and black koji to basically make the fermentation starter more acidic and to kind of have a more stable fermentation.
Yeah, if you want to go back and listen to it, I have to look at the episode number, our Junmai Aruten
episode. Oh, that's
episode.
Right, yeah.
Mm. We talk about the nature of the use of, the nature of utilizing lactic acid bacteria
that's
for
right.
yeah. Sokujo or like Kimotoyama High styles. We talk a bit about that and why somebody would do that. So as to not to have to include some of those additives. You're seeing some places utilize white koji.
Natural,
as a,
natural in a way. It's arguably, it's a tricky one.
That's the pretext.
Yeah, that's the way the industry sees it, to be fair. Yep. I mean, if you don't, you know, you're not adding anything, any additives, they can write that on the bottle.
Yep.
And it becomes a little bit of an extra selling point. And one reason why black and white were kind of kept out of sake brewing for a long time is because they produced a little bit too much citric acid, maybe for the traditional palate. Whereas, as you're saying, I think, you know, with diet changes, more kind of oily food out there, because obviously, you know, if you've got a lot of oily food, you want to have maybe more acidity in the sake. That's one way of creating that more modern palate.
Yeah, and I guess it was a little bit off topic, but I mentioned a minute ago that so awamori was originally made with yellow koji because it doesn't have so much of that acidity, and where awamori is made is in Okinawa.
That's right.
And then even shochu production down in Kyushu and western and southern Japan, where you have a much warmer, more humid climate, it's not quite as cold in the winter, you're running up against potential for things spoiling, for things going bad. But by using something like a black koji or a white koji, you're able to create an environment that is better at keeping out those unwanted bacteria and organisms and things. And so that became popular, not just in order to create flavor, specific flavor profiles, but also to essentially create a stable product as well. Now that we have temperature controlled facilities and tools and a better understanding of the microorganisms that we're coexisting with and collaborating with in the process of making this stuff, you're actually now starting to see also the flip side. Soju producers use yellow koji, things that are slightly less acidic, and you'll find shochu out there that has very ginjo like aromas, or it has a very, you know, much softer palates and things like that. And so you're kind of seeing this interesting sort of cross section where shochu is getting a little bit more sake like, and sake is becoming a little bit more shochu like, not necessarily tasting like shochu, but trying to take on the more complex characteristics and character that you might find or might be more inherent in shochu, while at the same time sort of mellowing out shochu for the uninitiated palate attempt to bring it out there. So
it's fun to break the rules.
What's it? Yeah, it is.
Absolutely. And so probably our listeners will be wondering at this point, kind of where does this Aspergillus oryzae come from? And it's kind of Japan's national mold, isn't it? It's out there growing, you know, domestically, if you like. And I mean, it almost feels like a miracle that we kind of have this, you know, that they discovered this and kind of applied it to sake brewing. If you want to actually go out and this mold you would find growing on, I believe you find it growing on rice plants, on the ears of rice plants.
Yeah, so it's hard to pinpoint exactly where and in what form it was being extracted for use and through what means, because it is something that is naturally occurring all around us, where a place that you will commonly see Aspergillus oryzae or something very similar to it is on the rice stalks, on the husks. If you go out to a rice field, say in the autumn, and you poke around and you look at some of the grains on there, you might see some that are covered with sort of a greenish, brownish, moldy looking thing that could very well be koji. It could also very well be a
could be anything.
Deadly cousin of koji that is almost the exact same thing.
So you need to get it checked in a laboratory. You need to get it kind of analyzed, and you can't just go out and pick this off a rice ear and then go and use it in sake production. Yeah. So most breweries don't do that, right? They purchase their koji spores from a koji supplier. So we call them moyashiya, right? There's that word again, moyashi, the bean sprouts, basically a bean sprout maker, if you like, factory. And traditionally, I believe that the brewers weren't even maybe making the koji inside the brewery as well. They were maybe being made outside and then shipped to the brewery.
Well, in the history of sake brewing, Kyoto played a very important role when it was the imperial capital of Japan. And kojiya, so the businesses producing koji, were very powerful. And they were organized as a guild, and they were supplying sake brewers with koji. And it's interesting to note that while kojiya had a right to brew sake, sake brewer has no right to make koji. So there was a key privilege of kojiya.
Getting back to a lot of the question that a lot of people have is, so where does koji come from? Where does this stuff come from? And so, yes, it is a naturally occurring mold. Yes, you can technically find it out in nature. Originally, where did it come from? How was it used? How did it utilized? Right. How did people access this and use it in making not only sake, but these other things in fermentation? Originally from China in some way, shape, or form. That's where the know-how for working with this stuff came from. The Buddhist monks that were, huddled up at sort of the great information centers, 1300 years ago or whatnot, figured out how to really work with this stuff. And so that's where it really came from. And it came through a process of natural discovery. It was something that was in some form noticed in China, brought from China, and they were able to suss out in some manner, possibly accidentally, that this can be utilized and this can be made.
Should we use domestication or something?
I think domestication is a very good word for it, because there is an argument out there, or there is reason to believe that the koji that we talk about today isn't something that, quote unquote, for lack of a word, naturally existed in Japan. It was something that was domesticated by the Japanese people who were living, thriving, working with the rice fields, who are making sake, who are making these other things, and that through this sort of natural process of elimination and the right things, and just having the right things in the right place at the right time, that a particular strain was essentially domesticated and used, and it was sort of evolved along with the needs and purposes through which the Japanese people started working with it. And so it's kind of like it was domesticated. And then so now actually the koji that you will find in nature is kind of like stray dogs, essentially. It wasn't something that was initially there. And so where are producers getting them from? Stepping back to what you were talking about before,
that's
about
right.
Moyashiya, they call them the tane kojiya. Tane literally means seeds or spores. And what you have now is you have a number of entities scattered throughout Japan, a very limited number of entities. Their job is essentially to gather, cultivate, and keep these traditional strains of koji, as well as develop new strains. And a lot of them also work in yeasts and other types of, say, lactic acid bacteria and a lot of other things that breweries use in fermentation and things like that. It's funny because they're actually only about 10 to 12 that are still really operating in Japan. So all of the not just sake producers, miso, soy sauce, mirin, all these different places that are making all of these things are all selecting which koji it is they're going to use, what they call the tane koji, or the koji seeds or spores from this limited number of places. That being said, it's really only a handful of about 4 or 5 that make up a large portion of the market of what's being used for sake. And the reason I say 4 or 5 is because I actually don't know exactly, because they're private businesses. They're not, run by any overarching, government agency or the tax office or anything like that. Like, to what degree are they actually operating and offering certain types of strains to different places without going to each one individually and really digging in? It's hard to say. but it's generally about four or five that make up the contributions to all of the koji available to all of the sake brewers.
It definitely seems like four or five. I mean, the breweries I've visited, occasionally I ask them like what, you know, strain of koji are they purchasing? And it tends to be one of four or five types. And so what the breweries essentially purchase is, well, they can purchase the spores in two kind of states. They can purchase them as just kind of like spores, basically just like powder, or they can purchase them as granules. So it's like rice with the mold grown on it until it actually produces the spores. I think most breweries tend to use the powder type now because it kind of allows you to inoculate the rice at like a really nice density. If you think about it, you've only got so many spores on the actual granule of rice, so it's not really an efficient way of doing it. But yeah, so it's generally, that's how the brewery purchases from these moyashiya or tanikojiya.
Whereas I know of a number of breweries who are cultivating their own yeast and reusing their own yeast, I don't know of a brewery cultivating their own koji. I mean, I know of one in Chiba that is using some wild koji, so that koji that you were referring to, Justin. But clearly these four or five companies are very key stakeholder in the industry, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely.
There are some projects to produce kind of, you know, new strains of like consortiums, if you like, of brewers that have got together and trying to make their own koji. So last time we had a sake from, in the last recording, we had a sake from, which is kind of being made by a consortium of brewers that found a kind of a new strain. Well, it's not a new strain of koji. They found koji mold growing kind of outside a shrine, right? And they've started to make some sake from that.
Yeah. So, well, these entities are basically they are holding on to the key of you know, for Japan's fermentation culture, which is the core of the food culture.
That's right.
Breweries or different groups might be work to develop certain yeasts or local yeasts or different varieties. There are places that you can do that for koji as well too. But when speaking with them, they actually say, you know, creating something new isn't that hard. Preserving something that has been around for a long time, so that's a whole lot harder to actually keep it in the state that it has been for how many decades or hundreds of years. A lot of the places that are, you know, really active today that are providing a lot of these spores have been around for 100 years, give or take. And when asking them, so the spores that you have, those original ones, where did those come from? A lot of them, they don't necessarily know. They said it was probably from a sake brewery that was already using it. It probably wasn't taken from nature in some place like that, you know. And so when it gets in, the question is, so where did this koji come from and from when and how ancient is it? You know, it really is hard to say.
And they all kind of produce a different product, don't they? So they're all kind of produce different types of koji with different like traits, if you like, different characteristics. And of course, a brewer will choose their koji based on the type of... So again, it all comes down to necessity, function. What are they trying to produce? What is their end goal? What type of style of sake are they trying to produce at the end? And the koji that they select will be selected for that purpose. So if they want to, you know, if they want a koji with more mold growth, faster mold growth, and particular characteristics, I don't know what those might be, but they will choose a particular type of koji to facilitate that. And I just remembered something. We were talking about earlier about, so I was saying that you generally used tsukihase to make ginjo. I believe the koji does actually produce lipids, and those can actually inhibit the ginjo aromas. So that's another strong reason why they might not use
Yeah, I guess it would depend. Yeah, I guess what type of ginjo are you striving
to
make?
Absolutely.
You know,
do you really want a full-on ginjo or whatever? Yep. But
generally, from the textbook, that's generally what you would. Yeah. That's only what the textbook would tell you. Yep.
The process of producing koji takes about 48 hours. Most breweries will tend to use fresh koji in the shubo, and then koji is used in the main moroi, in the main fermenting mash as well. But koji can be dried.
And it actually is. And that's actually what you actually see is a lot of the sake brewers when they're making koji is after it is quote unquote done, they will create an environment that is super dry, and they will put different fans or different things that's in there in order to dry it out more, in order to stop it
and cool it down as well. That, that's key as well.
And that's in a way it's similar to sort of with malt and things like that as well too. When you're trying the to kilning, stop it, right? At the point where this is the balance of enzymes that you're looking for.
Yeah,
because at that point you don't need the mold anymore.
No.
What you want is to keep the stock of enzymes.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
You don't want to the other thing is you don't want to overgrow the mold so that you actually kill it. So you got to be really careful because it gets really hot towards the end of the process. And if you don't like cool it down and dry it out, the mold will just keep growing and growing and growing until the point where it actually dies. And when it dies, it produces horrible aromas that you don't want.
If you keep growing it and growing and growing under the right conditions, then you can get koji mold again that you can then use the spores in order to make koji. So that's actually, I mean, that's essentially what they're doing at those, at the tanekoji, is they're essentially.
But it's controlled killing or overgrowing, isn't it? Yeah. No. You don't kill it. You kind of just overgrow it. Yeah.
Actually, I was just, a couple months ago, I was visiting Akita Konno, which is tanekoji up in Akita. And they were talking about, they have essentially a koji kanpyokai, which I guess in sake terms, it's basically all the sake breweries once a year, they submit their sakes. It's usually like a daiginjo or something of that nature. And a bunch of individuals with exceptional palates get together and determine whether or not they reach their goal. You know, this is a little bit different, wherein that what they do is they basically, once a year, it's a demonstration to producers of what they can do, what can be done. And so they're actually constantly doing test brews and trying to demonstrate the depth and breadth which the koji that they make and the different varieties that they have can be used. And so then once a year they have not just sake makers, but, you know, miso makers, sometimes, you know, people who make bread at their bakeries, or you know, cosmetics companies or places come out, and they'll come out, and what they will do is they'll come out and try them and sort of judge them in reference to their utility and how they feel like they can.
Cosmetics is a massive industry for koji, isn't it? Because one of the great things about koji is that it produces something called kojic acid, and you know, we have now pretty much having scientific evidence that this actually has various benefits, beauty-related benefits. If you ever meet a brewer, the first thing that you might notice is how beautiful their skin is, right? And like, most of them will probably put it down to the fact that they're in constant contact with koji. And so you can actually buy these cosmetic products now, which include koji acid as one of the ingredients. It's a big, big industry, big industry.
And it's becoming a bigger and bigger industry.
Bigger, yeah.
Amino rice is the word that they often mention on the labels.
Yeah.
Amino rice. Yeah.
As much as we've tried to simplify koji, it's entirely possible we've confused you exponentially. But it was a valiant effort, and we discovered going through this process exactly how challenging it is to convey the importance and significance of this business without having all these physical, tangible things to see and taste and try and right up in front of you. And so all the more reason to pay a visit to this little island in the Pacific and come and explore. With that, let's check out of here. Chris, Sebastian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Justin.
Thanks so much. We'll do more koji in another capacity with individuals out there who know significantly more than we do. I will get that arranged because I want to make it happen.
Yeah.
And it will happen. Until then, you can get in touch with us at questions@sakeonair.com, as well as find us on all social media channels at sakeonair. Any review or comment for that review helps us a great, great, great deal. So if you could take a moment out of your day in order to do that, that helps us so, so much. We can't even begin to tell you. We would be infinitely grateful to all of you. With that has been another episode of Sake on Air, broadcast from the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center here in Tokyo, and made possible with the wonderful support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association. Kanpai.